I remember the day Fidel marched into Havana. It was January 8, 1959. I was 4 years old. What I remember is my dad coming home that day, taking me with him down to greet los rebeldes, the rebel soldiers. There was a huge parade. There was a lot of confetti, cars honking. I was up on my father's shoulders, and someone, wearing a rebel army uniform, reached up to give me a hug and a kiss. Looking down at his hairy chest, I saw a rosary with red crystal beads and a cross. It was a big celebration.
Y las ruinas de las calumnias se levanta hoy pujante el primer Estado socialista alemán.
Later, Fidel went from somebody we liked a lot to somebody we feared.
Su amistad indestructible, su cariño profundo y su gratitud eterna.
Little by little, adults became worried. Young men were being killed by government firing squads. During the Bay of Pigs invasion, my sister and I slept in the bathtub of our home because bombs were dropping, and the tub was the safest place in the house. There were rumors that the government would take us away from our parents. And when the government shut down the schools, including the one I attended, my parents started talking about sending me to the United States. And then one day, I was packing my suitcase, laying out a dress for the trip, my handbag, and picking the doll that I wanted to take, and leaving. At the airport, there were what seemed like hundreds of kids. A hug and a kiss, and the last thing my mother told me was to remember to take a bath every day, that Americans didn't take too many baths. That was the last thing she said.
I first got the permit to bring out 500 children. And we got that, I think, in early 61.
Tim Baker directed a school in Havana. He was one of a handful of Americans who saw it as their mission to save Cuban children from communism. I was just beginning my story when we spoke and still new at recording.
One of the fathers that I knew who was very much involved in the underground came to me to ask me if I could get his son into a school in the States because they feared that if they were arrested, sent to prison, their children would be sent to Russia, as had happened in Spain. So I went to Washington to see what I could do to work out some kind of plan.
In an unprecedented move, the American government gave Father Brian Walsh the authority to waive visa requirements for children. Mimeographed copies of letters with his signature were smuggled into Cuba and distributed throughout the island. He remembers telling U.S. officials that once the children were in the States, he would take responsibility for their care.
When they talked to me from the State Department, they mentioned that, well, we know that you can get help for these children, but we want you to accept unqualified responsibility for the children while they're in the United States.
The failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion added pressure to get out. And so what had begun as a program to evacuate the children of the Cuban opposition mushroomed. From April 1961 to October 1962, more than 13,000 children were sent to the United States. Most parents who sent their children believed that they would be reunited in a few months. In my case, that worked. My parents arrived 4 months after I did. But following the October missile crisis, the United States canceled all flights between the U.S. and Cuba, and 8,000 other children were stranded without their parents.
Maybe it's a kind of miracle for people to take strangers to live in their homes, even children. And then, when the time comes, when Cuba is free, give them back to their real parents. And you have to wait for miracles.
Their tragedy was turned into propaganda. In 1962, the U.S. government commissioned a documentary film about the Cuban children who came to Miami in Operation Pedro Pan. It's called The Lost Apple.
Why would Papa and Mama do this? How could they send you to a far and lonesome place where you have no friends? Fidel Castro.
I first came across this film 5 years ago at a gathering of Pedro Panners. The film is a powerful reminder of an experience that many of us are only now beginning to come to grips with. In my research, I learned that Robert Kennedy, then U.S. Attorney General, approved making the documentary as part of the U.S. government's campaign against communism. The film was narrated in English and Spanish to reach a broader audience.
Children never think what they are taught in school can make much difference in what they will grow up to be. But parents know better. And in Cuba, when they saw their children taught strange things, they became frightened. That's the main reason they sent you here, so that you couldn't be changed into strangers in your very home.
Wayne Smith worked in the U.S. Embassy around the time I left Cuba. When I spoke to him recently, he told me something that had never been confirmed by government officials before, that it was the Central Intelligence Agency that initiated the visa waiver program and spread the rumors that Cuban children would be taken from their parents by Castro's government.
Based on conversations with a number of people, Cubans, people in the CIA, some of the consular officers in Cuba, and people in the Department of State, I came to the conclusion that the genesis, that the idea of Operation Peter Pan came from the CIA, that they put it forward, and that the idea was to frighten families who were afraid that they would lose their children. Spreading the idea that you better get your kids out while you can, they hoped would frighten the parents, would strengthen anti-government actions and attitudes in Cuba. And it also, it was good propaganda. All these kids coming out fleeing godless communism because the Cuban government might take them away from their parents. It was good from a propaganda angle, and they thought that it served the purposes of strengthening anti-government sentiments and actions in Cuba.
The CIA denies this allegation, and it's been hard trying to learn the truth about what was going on at the time we were sent out. To Cuba, we are kidnapped children. To Cuban exiles, Pedro Panners are living symbols of the fight against Castro. But recently, many of us have started to talk more openly about what we experienced. There are 14,000 different stories. These are just a few.
All I remember is the airplane was full of children under 18 years old. It was a KLM flight.
Raquel Mendieta was 15 and her sister Ana 12 when they were put on the plane for Miami.
And we were singing, you know, all the way, all the kids, and the Cuban national anthem, and all the songs, and all the stuff. And then we got to Miami, and the airport was not like it is now, of course. The plane, you had to go down the stairs. And as soon as we got down to the tarmac, Ana came down on her knees and started going, like, you know, with her arms on the floor and kissing the ground. Freedom! Freedom! And I says, get up from there! What are you doing? This is so embarrassing. So I finally got her off her knees and drug her inside the building.
In Miami, children were either sent to live with relatives or to the camps run by Father Walsh. Raquel and Ana were first sent to one just outside of Miami. As the numbers of children going to the camps grew, most were shipped off to orphanages, foster homes, and boarding schools across the country. Raquel Mendieta says that children would find out where they were going when their names appeared on a huge blackboard in the main building.
So when our names appeared on the board and it said Dubuque, Iowa, which we had no idea what that place was, never heard of it, didn't even know how to pronounce it. We looked at it and said, Dubuque, Iowa. What is that? Dubuque, Iowa. Nobody had heard who had gone there before or if anybody had gone there before. Nobody, you know, there was no history. There was no information about this place. And that really scared us.
Raquel and her sister Ana went to talk to a social worker who was there to answer the children's questions. Raquel says she spoke for the two sisters.
I said, well, I have a lot of concerns about this place. I hear a lot of stories about reform schools and children that have been mistreated and that are in with delinquents and, you know, having violent experiences and things. And, you know, I don't want my sister and I to end up in a place like this. And they said, oh, you're not going to a reform school. You will be going to a home.
Raquel and Ana were first sent to St. Mary's, an orphanage for troubled girls in Dubuque, then to several foster homes, then to separate schools. Their mother arrived in the U.S. 5 years later. Raquel was 19 and living on her own. Her father spent years in Cuban prisons. By the time he came to the United States, 17 years had passed. Other children were sent from the camps directly to foster homes. Many of those experiences were good. I spent 4 months in a nurturing home in Miami with friends of my parents, Nenita and Pucho Greer, and their two children. But as Pedro Pons have begun to share their experiences, there are also sad stories, stories that have been hidden for years.
Tonight is talent night. This is Dulce Maria. She is going to sing a song of the country people of Cuba.
Dulce Maria Sosa Menéndez was 10 years old and living in one of the Miami refugee camps when she was featured in the propaganda film. Standing on a small stage in a crowded room, Dulce Maria sings about her love for Cuba as the camera shows close-ups of teary-eyed children in the audience. Dulce Maria left Cuba with her sister and brother in July 1962. They lived in a camp for several months before being placed in a foster home in California. Dulce, who now goes by the name Candy, says she and her siblings were told they were lucky because their foster family spoke Spanish and they were interested in music, just like Dulce. But she says her foster father abused her.
1 or 2 days after I had arrived, and he and I were alone in the kitchen, he was sitting at the table and I was standing eating, I think, some, I don't know what. And it's the first time that he made a comment about he couldn't wait to kiss my lips or touch my breast. I had no breasts. And when I was offered to be taken to, you know, to be given these lessons to develop my talent, I thought it was, you know, it was very good, except that that's where the episode started. So during the visits to my piano and voice lessons is when he would fondle me and kiss me, and then that's, you know, honestly, all of that has been so closed off, I have very little recollection. I remember only that it grossed me out because he was a very heavy smoker and had kind of like an ongoing pneumonia, and his lips were like purple, and he was always coughing this nasty green stuff. And that was my first kiss.
It came a point probably after 1 year that I realized that I might never go back. So I lived with that was it. I wasn't going to ever see my family again.
Rafael Ravelo was 13 in 1961 when his parents decided to send him alone to the United States. He didn't end up in the camps. Instead, he spent years living in Costa Rica and the Dominican Republic with the Christian Brothers, a Catholic order. As an adult, he moved to Chicago. 18 years passed before Rafael saw his family again. It was 1979, and Cubans were being allowed to return to the island for the first time.
I got scared. I got very scared because so many years have gone by. All of a sudden, I feared that I wasn't going to recognize my mother, that I wasn't going to recognize my father, that I wasn't going to recognize my sister, that I had changed a lot because I left at 13 and I was 31. You know, it was a huge change in my life. And I didn't know whether they were going to feel comfortable with me, and then all of those things. So it was very scary type of feeling, but it was very exciting too. He was like, I don't care what happens. I just have to get this over with. I have to go and see them.
Rafael was given a visa for only 1 week. He was amazed, he says, that even after 18 years, he felt comfortable with his family within minutes of seeing them.
We stayed every night until 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning, and he was telling stories. I remember in my room, there were like 12 people sleeping on the floor. And for me, that was so important. It was the touching. It was the... They didn't want 1 minute to go by and waste it because I was there. And they wanted to make sure that they were there the 24 hours. And I remember one night, like the second night, I woke up. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And my mother's looking at me. You know, I'm like, oh, God. She was just looking at me and she would do this. Yeah, that was real hard.
Rafael still lives in Chicago and is a social worker. Raquel is an artist and lives in Miami. Her sister, Anna, died in 1985. Candy is a musician in California. The Pedro Pan experience has deeply marked all of us. Some say that it has made us more sensitive to the needs of others and perhaps more reconciliatory in our style of politics. Others say that we're all overachievers and all success stories. But through combined efforts, we have only been able to locate around 3,000 of the 14,000 children, hardly a number from which we can generalize. Many of us are grateful to be here. Maybe, had we stayed, we could be facing the same tough choices our parents had.